listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. This is yesterday, today, and tomorrow in Russia. You might be hearing all this pomp and ceremony about this being a very sensitive time right now for Ukraine. Because Russia is celebrating these 3 days and has all the way back to the end of World War II as Victory Day. This was when the Russians rolled into Berlin, when they won World War II. Basically, I think this is when the truce was signed. We used to call it VE, Victory in Europe Day, here in the U.S. And it's a big deal over there. And I mention this because this was the last time on a large stage, and I realize the old saying that, you know, he who mentions Hitler first loses the argument. But nonetheless, the Nazis had a state religion. And in fact, they had a state preacher. His name was Bishop Mueller. He committed suicide after World War II. He was in charge of the official Christian church of the Third Reich. And our founders were not unaware of this sort of thing. We had the same sort of problem in Massachusetts, which had a state religion and, you know, the old Pilgrims and Plymouth Rock thing. And they used to put women to death regularly in Massachusetts to the point that when he was 17 years old, Ben Franklin said enough of this and got the hell out of town, went to Pennsylvania and never went back. And in fact, that was one of the big issues when Massachusetts joined the Union. Was they were very upset about the establishment of religion clause in the Constitution, and it was part of a huge ratification debate in the state of Massachusetts. But can you imagine being Jewish, particularly this being the week when, in the name of Jesus, a state claiming a state religion killed 6 million of your fellow human beings? And fellow Jews, having the Supreme Court say that a prayer like this, this is the prayer that was said in the city of Greece a short time ago, that a prayer like this being basically forced on you is a good thing. Here we go.
We look with anticipation to the celebration of Holy Week and Easter. It is in the solemn events of next week that we find the very heart and center of our Christian faith.
Keep in mind, this is opening a town council meeting.
We acknowledge the saving sacrifice of Jesus Christ on the cross. We draw strength, vitality, and confidence from his resurrection at Easter. Jesus Christ, who took away the sins of the world, destroyed our death. Through his dying and in his rising, he has restored our life. Blessed are you who has raised up the Lord Jesus. You who will raise us in our turn and put us by his side.
And this is how they open a city council meeting. Susan Galloway is with us. She was the litigant in the Supreme Court case that was decided this week. It was the town of Greece v. Galloway. You are the Susan Galloway. Susan, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us. I understand that you are Jewish, that Linda Stevens, who joined you, is an atheist, and that when you heard that prayer and others similar to it opening town events, it did not please you.
No, it was an ongoing thing. Right before we filed the lawsuit, they had a few, and I will use the word tokens, of different faiths, but really did not have anybody before that was not Christian do the prayer for over 10 years.
Right. Well, now that the Supreme Court has said that it's okay, and in fact, there was, I noticed down in Alabama, there's a young man who just sued a school for the same thing, and I'm guessing that they're going to cite the Supreme Court ruling and strike it down. Now that this has begun, how's the town of Greece going to deal with the Church of Satan worshipers out of New York City that has already paid to put together a monument to, you know, down in Alabama, Judge Moore's backyard, and other organizations that might not be quite so conventional as whoever this guy was?
Well, it's interesting because I just spoke with Linda Stevens, who did an interview today on the local public TV station, and the new supervisor, Rylick, was there, and I guess he said that they were getting a lot of strange phone calls from strange people, according to what she said, and that it'll be interesting. And he mentioned, I guess, the spaghetti monsters.
Oh, the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monsters. Yes.
And it'll be interesting to see how they handle that.
It will be. You would think that they would give. Now, maybe they'll allocate it according to population or something. But then, you know, there might even be a basis for a whole brand new lawsuit.
Well, according to them, they said that it is first come, first serve. So when you call and ask to be put on, you know, do it, then you are the next. You are put on the next time that it's open.
Uh-huh. So if you represent the Church of Lucifer, or if you represent the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster, or Zoroastrians, which are actually serious religious folks, give them a call. All right, the Supreme Court in their ruling said, our tradition assumes that adult citizens firm in their own beliefs can tolerate and perhaps appreciate a ceremonial prayer delivered by a person of a different faith. They're basically saying to you, get over it. What's your response to that?
Well, I've really felt that the town having years and years and years of fully Christian prayer givers was aligning itself with Christianity. And as somebody who goes there to petition my government, originally we went there over our public cable access issue. And I felt that, it's not conducive to people feeling welcome. It's not conducive for people feeling that if they don't do what the majority is doing or follow it, that they might have problems when they want to ask for something because they look like they're being disrespectful or whatever, the people who are making the decisions decide. Or, interpret that action.
What kind of, we just have a minute left, Linda, what kind of blowback have you gotten, or Susan, excuse me, from filing this case? Any?
Well, we got hate mail. The other litigant, Linda Stevens, got vandalism done to her home several times. We had some of the prayer givers gave disparaging remarks during their prayer time towards us.
Oh, that's very Christian of them.
Yeah. So, we've gotten, there's a lot of people that think we're anti-Christian. But the thing is that there were Christian faith denominations that actually wrote amicus briefs in support of us, American Baptist,
right.
United Church of Christ.
Well, this was, James Madison, who professed Christianity, which was not that common among the founders, was very, very worried about the breakdown of the separation of the wall between church and state because he was afraid that that his religion would get corrupted by the government.
Well, and I think that you can see how that can happen. You can see it all over the world.
Yep.
And you don't have a separation of church and state.
Yep, absolutely. Very, very well said. Susan Galloway, a litigant in the Supreme Court case, Town of Greece v. Galloway. Susan, I congratulate you on your courage to stand up and take this on. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
How would you deal with a prayer opening your town meeting, and what if it was a prayer to Satan? And welcome back. Nate Sweet, international media superstar and producer of The Big Picture, on the line with us. Mr. Sweet, how are you on
How's
this
it going,
fine
Tom?
Day? Good. So we are going to open with a short rant and then Mr. Papantonio tonight.
Yes, the Koch brothers, or the Kochtopus, as we like to affectionately call them, are spreading their tentacles into the judiciary now. They actually helped to host an event in Charleston, South Carolina at the end of last month that was a little seminar for judges looking to settle or decide cases about pension reforms. And basically, it was a way to instruct these judges in how to gut pension, public pensions altogether. Pretty interesting stuff. Pat's going to be talking about that. Obviously, he has, you know, a vast encyclopedia of legal knowledge, so he'll be really letting loose on this topic. And
well, especially after we had this discussion with David Sirota last.
Exactly. You know, I think what's particularly scary is, you know, when the Koch brothers get into something, it usually means that's where the right wing is going these days. And
could you be sure, Nate, that Pap has a copy of David Sirota's article?
As soon as
possible.
We'll do that. Definitely, that's a great idea.
Yeah,
it seems to be the next forefront in ALEC and right-wing legislation sort of tackling these public pensions because it's a great opportunity for pirate capitalism or shock doctrine type of capitalism. You can force these public pensions into the stock market and the disguise of reforming them and helping out the taxpayers, but you actually rip taxpayers off when you're doing that.
Yep. And in the second block, we have a guy who's twice been a great mind guest and a guest several other times on our program on the Big Picture and also on this radio show. For years and years.
Yeah,
Ralph
really,
Mayer.
Yeah, really great opportunity. Ralph is coming on to talk about his new book, Unstoppable, the Emerging Left-Right Alliance to Dismantle the Corporate State. And the basic idea is that, you know, on a lot of issues, there's a point of agreement between libertarians and some conservatives, Tea Party conservatives, and we as progressives. And he really wants to build on those coalitions to help create real change in this country. So we'll get his thoughts on that as well.
Yeah.
Get on that. And then his thoughts on that and some other issues as well.
Yeah. The guy that I voted for president in 2000.
Yeah.
In fact.
He's one of the true gems of American politics. Always great to hear his thoughts.
Ralph Nader has probably changed this country more or been responsible for changing this country more than any person I can think of in my lifetime. I'd have to go back to my father's lifetime to FDR for anybody who has had the kind of impact that Ralph Nader has had, in my humble opinion.
Well, I think it's because the issues he campaigns on and advocates for are issues that cut across every aspect of American life, whether you're a liberal, a conservative, a Democrat, or Republican. They, you know, consumer rights, dealing with corporations, there's something every American has to deal with, and I think they can identify with that.
Oh, yeah. And back in the 70s when he was doing this stuff, when he started doing this stuff in a big way, actually in the 60s, it was totally apolitical. This was not a left-right issue.
Yeah.
And
I think that's what he's trying to get at now, is to move this stuff away from partisan politics and just basic, you know, lifestyle. You know, what kind of country do we want to have?
Get it back to it. In our Your Take, My Take segment tonight, this is a last chance if you want to send in a question to yourtakemytake@gmail.com. Take a video question, record it really quick, send it off. Kurt will probably check that account one more time in the next hour or two before we put together the show for tonight.
Yeah, I don't think we can emphasize enough how much we like the video questions and the questions on the rant line. It's always great to give us some time to bring us some thoughtful responses to them. So definitely get those video questions coming.
There you go. In our Daily Take, are banksters responsible for America's explosion of autism?
Yes, pretty explosive Daily Take. Some interesting stuff in there about student loans and, you know, the social ramifications that the student loan debt crisis is having for America right now.
Yep. Okay. Nate, thank you.
Thanks, Tom.
I'll see you tonight. Says, well, you know, the First Amendment, which said the government shall not establish a religion, no longer means, as it has up until this year for the first, you know, all of history of American history, no longer means that the government shall not basically endorse a religion by pushing a prayer out. Now, back in a case back in the 70s or 80s, I think it was, the Supreme Court said that it was okay for Congress to open with a prayer because there was just a long history of it, and it really was just Congress, and it wasn't the people, you know. But a town council meeting, city council meeting, this is where your average citizens, everybody, is confronted by this. And I predict this is now going to migrate into our schools and into our other public venues. You're going to have members of Congress opening town hall meetings with prayers. I mean, it's going to start getting weird. They're going to be trying to shove it in our face. How do you respond? How do you respond if you go to your congressman's town hall meeting and you want to bring up the topic of single-payer health care, and your congressman happens to be a fundamentalist born-again Christian who opens the meeting with a long prayer? Or if your congressman happens to be the guy in the Republican Party who flipped the stars upside down on the logo and has decided to come out as a Satan worshiper and does a five-minute opening prayer to Lucifer. I personally would feel uncomfortable with that. John, in Geneva, Illinois, listening on TuneIn Radio, which has a brand new, they're rolling out a brand new spiffy app, by the way. John, thanks for listening to Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn. What's up?
You're very welcome, Tom. I heard of this case in Greece, but what did the decision hinge on? How did they determine that it's okay to open with a prayer? I missed that part.
To quote from the decision, our tradition assumes that adult citizens, firm in their own beliefs, can tolerate and perhaps appreciate a ceremonial prayer delivered by a person of a different faith. Now, that, I think, gives them an out with regard to schools, because they said adult persons. But, you know, basically that's the essence of the opinion of the court. The main argument that they made in Greece versus Galloway is that because we've been doing it for so long, we can keep doing it. History.
Oh, okay.
You know,
my own experience is that I was on city council in my town for about 7 years, and we always opened, the same guy opened every meeting with a Christian prayer, and I was always uncomfortable with it, and went to the extent of going to the mayor and said, you know, we should switch it up. We should let other members of the council open with their own prayer, you know, instead of hearing the same thing every week. So he said, sure, you can be next. Well, my prayer was really along the lines of, you know, we hope that all of us will seek wisdom from whatever higher power or none, you know, that we choose to worship. And he never did ask anyone else to open with a prayer again.
That was the end of it?
That was it. Yeah.
Amazing.
We went right back to the same guy who we called it, he'd give the weather report because he would thank Jesus for the wind and the rain.
That's great. Well, John, it's going to be really interesting in the town of Greece to see what happens after somebody from the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster and the Church of Satan gives a prayer. And I have a feeling that the exact same thing may happen. And I think that what the Supreme Court has done here has opened an incredible opportunity for guerrilla theater, for educational guerrilla theater, for every citizen in America to start petitioning their local political bodies that do open with prayers to say, I'd like to be the one who leads the prayer, or I would like to suggest a person who leads a prayer. And if you're not an ordained minister, you can become one on the internet with $25. And what was that church that people were using to get out of the Vietnam War? They tried to for the first year or so. It's been too many years. I can't remember the name of it. But there's numerous ways that you can get ordained. And ain't all that difficult. John, did you, in fact, was the guy who was doing the prayer in Geneva, Illinois, was he a minister or was he just some guy who was really religious?
Yeah, he was just a guy that was really involved in his evangelical church.
Yeah.
That was it.
Yeah.
You know, we had a chaplain, but he was more for police and fire duty.
Yeah. Oh, you mean to do funerals and things?
Yeah. Or, you know, to show up at the scene and.
Oh, to deal with if somebody's dying.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Or to deal with the families of grieving people. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Okay. Well, John, thanks for the call. It's going to be a really interesting time. And I think that the Supreme Court has opened the door to, there's only three now surviving members of the Firesign Theater, but they have to be licking their chops at this. and the people who do guerrilla theater all over this country. The Yes Men, oh boy. 28 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
For that matter, you can start your own church, you know? The Church of the Gooey Deaf God Stamp Redemption Center. How's that? Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. And what kind of can of worms has the court opened here? This is very interesting. And meanwhile, majorities of Americans are losing faith, no pun intended, in the Roberts Supreme Court. That's the headline from the Huffington Post. I wonder if they intended for it to be that ironic. Probably not. An overwhelming majority of voters would support sweeping reforms to the Supreme Court. Yeah, how about Congress passing, you know, some legislation to restrain the court? They have the authority under Article 3, Section 2. Congress can pass exceptions on what the court can rule on, and they can regulate the court. Of course, it's not going to happen as long as Congress is controlled by Republicans. Koch brothers and major corporations. Well, we're going to get into that with Mike Papantonio in just a few minutes. So first, let me pick up some of your calls. I know a lot of people want to get in and talk about this. Diana in Westminster, Colorado, listening on AM 760. Hey, Diana, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I think that I don't think any city council meetings, any taxpayer-funded meetings should be opened with any kind of prayer anywhere. I think people should pray on their own time.
I agree.
And I don't embrace any man-made religion, and I'm very happy with my recipe for spirituality, and I don't push it on anybody else. And I just am really uncomfortable with the thought of my tax dollars being wasted. That's how I see it, because you can pray anytime you want. People are saying, oh, they're taking our ability. You can't pray anywhere. Bullpucky. You can pray anywhere you want. Can't you pray inside your own head?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't think that should.
Well, I was saying a prayer as I was walking into work this morning, but the last overtly religious thing I did, I suppose, is there's this big tree out on Water Street out in front of our marina. I mean, a big old oak tree. And I, every time I walk by it, I put my hands on it and I say a few words to it and I try to exchange a little energy with the tree. And, you know, it's kind of an old druid thing. I mean, maybe somebody could show up with a tree at one of these things and pray to the tree and or talk to the tree or whatever. I don't know.
Maybe so. I'm just at this point, I'm uncomfortable with it. And the gentleman said he was uncomfortable with somebody opening with a Christian prayer. And I'm uncomfortable with people assuming I wait tables for a living. And this woman and I had a conversation about some current event. And she said to me, well, we Christians need to stick together.
Yeah,
she
right.
Squeezed my hand. And in that setting, I wasn't about to open up that can of worms with her. I just smiled
sure.
And, you know, walked away. But it didn't hurt me physically, but I was offended that she just assumed that because I'm a good person and we agreed on this particular thing that I must also be a Christian.
Yeah, yeah. And it's even if you are, your definition, I mean, I call myself a Christian, but my definition of Christianity is fairly broad, and there are a lot of Christians who would say that I'm not, or that I'm not their kind of Christian. And so, it's just like, this should not be the business of government. I'm with you. Diana, thank you for the call. Well said. Mimi in Seattle, Washington, listening on KBCS. Hey, Mimi, how you doing?
Hey, I'm just finishing my notes. Okay, hey there, Tom. So, I want to respond to your opening question. How do we respond to these people? I think we don't respond to what they actually say, but to the dynamic/impact, disconnect, cognitive dissonance, reasons that people drag out in the conversations their words say.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, and we need to point out, you know, the absurdity of the actual actions and behaviors. And I would say, gosh, okay, let's look. If people don't agree with the separation of church and state, I would want to get right to the point and say, are you suggesting the Constitution needs to be amended and put the onus on them and
yeah.
not say, well, gosh, as an American, I would like to say, separate the damn church and state, man, already.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. There you go. Well, well said, Mimi. Thank you. Thank you for your sharing your thoughts. Bill in Prescott, Arizona. Hey, Bill. Napoleon?
Yeah. Good afternoon, Tom. Yeah, I remember one of his quotes when he was in that prison that he said that only thing good for religion is it keeps rich people from killing poor, from poor people killing rich people.
Uh-huh.
And I think that they utilize that, not necessarily the word killing, but they put up with a lot more.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. And it was used in the South, you know, just keep picking that cotton and someday you'll go to heaven. You know, the one freedom of speech that was very often allowed to slaves on the plantations was to sing religious songs. And, you know, with the idea that in the afterlife you will be rewarded if you work hard now. And or so the lore goes. I shouldn't represent myself as any kind of expert on slavery, but I've read words to that effect.
One more thing, Tom.
Yes, sir.
You know, I deplore what the Tea Party stands for. I can't believe they're getting away with it. But I'm not against the Baptist religion. Now, I deplore what Israel is doing, but I have nothing against Jewish religion. Mm-hmm. How would you talk about that, Tom?
Well, I think you could just say what you just said. I'm not sure what your question is. What do you mean?
Well, my question is, it seems like if you ever say something that Israel's not doing, you're anti-Semitic.
I think there's a small minority of people who take that position. It's certainly not the position they take in Israel. I've spent a fair amount of time in Israel. There's a very, and read Haaretz, the progressive newspaper. It's the second largest newspaper in Israel, I believe. And they're online in English. And there's a continuous and loud debate in Israel about, you know, everything from Gaza to the West Bank to, Iran. All the things that if you in the United States, if you bring out, there are some people who will come along and say, oh, you're being anti-Semitic. But no, not so much in Israel. Bill, thanks for the call. Dave in Arcata, California. Hey, Dave. Thanks for listening to KTLE. What's up?
I always listen to you happy years. I'm also Bertrand Russell in your chat room.
Oh, cool.
I mentioned that because I share the philosophy of Bertrand Russell. Also active with the Vets for Peace.
Mm-hmm.
I show up at city, county, state.
Yep. And you used to help Alice in her 90s,
yes,
as I recall, call into our show back 6, 8, 10 years ago.
Yeah, I still think of her often. But
yeah.
I find myself at a city call or county supervisors meeting, usually on behalf of the Vets for Peace.
Mm-hmm.
We oppose wars for profit and for Halliburton and Lockheed Martin and such. But I find I also have to sit down through Pledge of Allegiance and prayers, and that makes me feel like here I am looking like I hate my country. I don't. I just don't want to. I can't be standing in support of what you're doing there. And why is that being imposed on me in a free country?
Yeah.
It troubles me a lot.
It would be interesting to be a Christian, as a Christian pastor. I was ordained in a Christian religion, to be a Christian pastor and stand up and say, just overtly, something like, Lord Jesus, you who preached that we must feed the hungry among us or we will go to eternal damnation, that we must, when Peter cut off the ear of the centurion, that we should turn the other cheek against violence. Please forgive us the horrible things that our government and we, even in the city council, are doing by allowing poverty in our city. Just shame the city council with your prayer.
Yeah, for sure. You wouldn't be speaking for Halliburton on there.
No, you definitely not. In fact, you could apologize to Jesus for that one, too. Dave, thanks for the call. It's great to hear your voice. Bud in Belafonte, Pennsylvania. Hey, Bud, what's up?
All right. I'm so glad I got on, Tom. Thank you, thank you, thank you. I've been listening to you for years and calling in a lot, but it just takes so long. You know, at these city council meetings,
mm-hmm.
We ought to see whether the THC ministry can write a prayer for us. You know,
as in tetrahydrocannabinol.
As the country moves through legalization this year.
Yeah, well, there is the ayahuasca church. Now that would be interesting. There's not. a legal ayahuasca church in the United States, but there is in Brazil, and there are in several other South American countries, and, you know, where they take a psychedelic drug. It's two plants that they mix together, and it creates dimethyltryptamine, DMT, which is a psychedelic. And I have a friend whose wife is Brazilian. She has a U.S. passport as well. Her family is a member of one of these churches, and they go down there and they take this stuff, and everybody goes outside and throws up, and then they come back in, and for the next 4 or 5 hours they're standing there doing prayers and singing songs and hanging out with hallucinations of Jesus.
There already is a THC ministry. Check it
out. Oh, there is?
.com.
Oh, interesting. Is it called THCministry.com? Is that the website?
Yeah.
Wow.
.org. I know it's there.
I personally would consider, I would not argue against. I think I could make a strong argument in favor of pot being a sacramental plant.
Of course.
I certainly, in my early years, I used other psychedelics, peyote, psilocybin, and LSD in a sacramental context, in a church, in a Methodist church, in fact, in East Lansing, Michigan. Taking these drugs with a group of people with the specific intent of having a religious experience. I've been there, I've done that, and I mean, this was back before it was even illegal. It was powerful stuff. Powerful stuff. Bud, thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Pot I had always thought of as being more just, like beer, right? More recreation. But you spoke enough of it. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Willard in Ogdensburg, Wisconsin, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, Willard, what's on your mind today?
Well, I was wondering, you're talking on religion. Something interests me very much.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever tried progressive Christianity?
That
is not a fly-by-night thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's a worldwide organization, and it's founded, if you want to say, by top theological scholars,
mm-hmm.
and that's it.
Now, for a number of years, Louise and I used to go to the Unity Church in Michigan, and in fact, when we lived in Oregon, we went to the Unity Church in Portland a number of times. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, I'm sure. Bishop Spong.
I don't know.
One of the world's.
No, I think maybe they're two different things. The Unity Church has a long tradition of being, they evoke and invoke Christianity, but they're very all-inclusive, and there's a lot of people who show up who are not necessarily Christians.
It's because of the ingrained idea we have of Christianity. Now, I'm an old bugger. I'm 90 years old, and I didn't start studying this until I was like 70, 75, and I've spent most of my life at studying it.
Uh-huh.
And so I'm sold on it, and believe you me,
on progressive Christianity.
I had to change everything that I ever thought I knew.
Wow.
So,
is there a website? Is there a place I can learn more about progressive Christianity?
I'm sorry to say I never even looked that up myself.
Yeah.
I'm an old blossom, and I mean, I'm 90 years old, and I don't handle a computer very well.
Yeah. Well, I just turned 63 a couple of days ago, and I'm not the best at computers either. But in fact, it was yesterday. But in any case, First Church of Christ? No, what is the United?
Well,
I think it's the United Church of Christ is the one that was running the ads.
Like that. The byword to that is Christianity must change or die.
Yeah. Interesting.
So I see you can understand how radical that is.
Yeah.
And it's in every denomination that there is. There are certain spots of it. And it's known the world over. But as I said, it took a lot to convince me of it. As I taught everything except that until I get to looking at it. And then I'm pushing it and...
Yeah.
The first thing you do when you talk to a Christian is, you're nuts. That's all they say.
The big cleavage in Christianity that I've experienced in my lifetime among people who call themselves Christians are those who believe that they're Christians because of what they believe. In other words, they believe in the resurrection and all that kind of stuff, versus those who call themselves Christians because of what they do. They follow the teachings of Matthew 21. They want to feed the poor, heal the sick, house the homeless, that kind of thing. And does progressive Christianity teach both or merely the latter?
Well, this here is a funny thing. You know, you got to say the byword to this here Christianity, this progressive Christianity, is love wastefully. If you can understand that, that's the basis for
love
all understanding.
Wistfully? What's the word after love?
Love wastefully.
How do you spell it?
Waste. W-A-S-T.
Ah, wastefully. Oh, in other words,
yeah,
just throw love out everywhere.
And it changes.
I love it. Okay, Willard, I got to run, but thank you. Tom Hartman here with you, helping you win the water cooler wars. Anne in St. Paul, Minnesota, listening on AM 950. You have some thoughts on prayer in public meetings? Anne?
Oh, yes, hi.
Hi.
I wanted to talk about that I think, you know, having a prayer before public meetings imposes kind of a religious test on our, you know, elected officials. And I think that should bother a lot of people.
Yeah.
You know, and by putting, you know, a religious test on them, it kind of puts a religious test on us. And, you know, how does an elected official deal with this? I wonder, you know, do people just walk away, or if they object or conscientiously object to something, and does that risk their candidacy or re-election or election in the first place?
Oh, it certainly would. I mean, there are a few groups as vilified in the United States as atheists, for example.
Yeah, I don't think it's a matter of whether you're an atheist or you're Christian or you're Jewish or Muslim. It's just, you know, I just don't think there should be a religious test.
I agree. And the Constitution agrees with you.
Yeah.
Five guys on the Supreme Court disagree with you, but the Constitution, in my opinion, agrees with you.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was something that, you know, the framers or, you know, the people who sat in a convention and thought about this for a couple of years and came up with our Constitution thought that, you know, a religious test is a bad idea.
Yep. And they wrote it into the Constitution. It specifically says there shall be no religious test for any public office.
But that's what we have today.
Oh, I don't disagree. I don't disagree. And I think that it's an implicit test, because if you were to stand up and start humming the Stars and Stripes or a Bette Midler song during the prayer, you would be soundly condemned by your peers. Or if you're sitting there playing Free Cell, whatever. Yeah, I think you're right, Ann. Thank you for the call. Sonia in North Highlands, California. Hey, Sonia, what's up?
Well, I was just telling the screener that in my personal opinion, religion is a concept that it's evil. It's an evil concept because religion is based on exclusion. And in my personal opinion, exclusion is an evil concept. For someone to actually think that other human beings are less than because they feel that they're more than, it's evil. It's evil to for someone to tell me that I'm going to go to hell because of whatever, you know, and they're going to go to heaven. It's a form of mental illness.
I'm not sure that all religions preach that we are more than, they are less than. I don't think Buddhism does.
It's basically the concept of most religions, it's exclusion. And I believe that exclusion is evil.
Yeah.
And by the way, my birthday was Sunday, May 4th. I turned 53. And
well,
your
good
birthday
on you.
Was...
Another Taurus.
But my experience, I'm in my 50s now, and I've encountered all sorts of people from different religions, and they were the meanest, rude, ugly people that I've ever met.
Yeah, religion has been used as a cloak for lots and lots of insanity and nasty behaviors. I'm with you, Sonia. Thank you for the call, and thanks for sharing your perspective. Jim in Highlands Ranch, Colorado, listening on AM 760. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Good afternoon, Tom. I'm in Highlands Ranch, Colorado, but I'm a native Michigander like you.
Oh, great.
I wonder if you have read John Meacham's book. It's a recent, not a few years now,
but it's American Gospel, God, the Founding Fathers, and the Making of a Nation.
No, I think the only book of his that I read was the one on Andrew Jackson.
Yes, well, you ought to. I think every American ought to read this one, American Gospel. You know, and what and the place of religion, how it developed in the United States. I think this recent Supreme Court decision is a terrible decision.
Yeah,
it's going to do a great deal of damage to this country.
I agree. I agree, and I think it's spitting in the face of James Madison. Jim, thank you for your call. Isaac in Windsor, Colorado. Hey, Isaac, you wanted to talk about my using drugs?
To a certain extent. Yeah, how are you doing, Tom?
Good.
Right on.
Sober.
Well, I think there you go. I think the church you were speaking of, which the Christian church uses the DMT, is the Santo Daime.
Santo Daime. Thank you very much. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, and I was just kind of a tangent off that. You know, I've been listening for years now. Called a couple times, and I was just wondering, like, you had mentioned that you got, like, you had planned your hallucinogenic trips with like-minded individuals for a religious purpose, and I was wondering if you actually ever got anything out of that.
Oh, it changed my life. I was 16. I was living in it was called the paper office. It was where the underground newspaper was published in East Lansing, Michigan, and about two blocks away, there was a Methodist church, and the pastor there was curious about all this stuff. This was back when most of these drugs were still legal. And a fellow by the name of Keith St. Clair had been sent out from San Francisco by Tim Leary he had sent out 12 disciples, basically, and brought some really good acid and a few other drugs. And they organized these things where they would invite 10 or 15 people to sit in the sanctuary and take these drugs and pray and listen to religious music and listen to Tim Leary's Tune In, Turn On, Drop Out album. And it was the first time in my life that I was confronted with the possibility that what I thought was absolute reality was not absolute reality. And that has colored my perspective ever since.
Right. What I've heard is that hallucinogens are the only drug you can take to make you question whether what you know as absolute is actually absolute.
Yeah, and this is one of the reasons, by the way, why they're using now hallucinogens so successfully to treat people who are dying of cancer and other things, to treat their panic and their depression. Because basically what they do is crack open other worlds, other consciousness. And, you know, speaking from experience. Now, I'm not recommending that anybody do that. And, in fact, I would recommend against it, given the set and settings today. It's all about set and setting. And I don't know of any deeply spiritual, very safe context in America anymore where these kind of drugs are used. Now they're party drugs. And I think that is an abomination. I think that's sacrilegious. And I'm strongly opposed to the use of those kind of drugs in that context.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com, everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And one of my favorite people, America's lawyer, Mike Papantonio, host of Ring of Fire Radio, Ring of Fire TV. The website is ringoffireradio.com, is on the line with us. Hey, Pap, welcome.
Tom, how are you?
I'm great. Apparently the Koch brothers are, too. They're not only pushing stuff like pollution, you know, for the benefit of their refineries and their paper companies, but they're sponsoring a pension reform seminar for judges? Really?
Yeah, the billionaire inheritance babies, they've done pretty good buying themselves a Supreme Court majority, but that really isn't enough for them. Now their new endeavor is to try to buy trial court judges and appellate judges in states. The reason they're doing that, Tom, is the way they're doing it is they're holding a big junket. They're going to invite, and they've done this several times. And again, corporate media hasn't reported it, but this time it's in South Carolina. It's nothing less than a junket. Champagne, cigars, free dinners, bring your wife, you're going to have, or your spouse, you're going to have a great time. And by the way, while you're there, we're going to indoctrinate you on the idea that the civil servant pensions are killing this country. Their goal is to convince these trial court judges that when a contract comes up before them, and the contract in question is the pension program valid, or was there a valid contract? Then they're going to ask them to say no, there is no contract here, even though in most states it's part of their state constitution that pension right flows forever. But what they've done is they're almost shameless in this. They're holding this meeting, and state court judges who are equally as shameless are showing up to be entertained and to walk away with a package of material like Alec would give them. This is an Alec kind of approach. It's being done by the George Mason Law School, which is questionable in and of itself. If you're in the legal business and somebody comes through from George Mason, you start asking yourself serious questions about why were you there. But the point is that particular law school is holding this in South Carolina. Now, what's really interesting about it is these judges, many of them are already sitting on cases. They're already involved with deciding cases today. Illinois, for example, in Illinois, you've got a judge up there that has to say this when he reviews this case. He has to say that notwithstanding the state constitution that ensures the validity of these pension programs, I'm going to say there's not a good contract there, or there is a good contract. So why should that judge or anybody like him be showing up in South Carolina? They won't give the names of the judges. They won't tell us who the judges are until 30 days after this takes place. And so this is a really ugly story that's not being talked about nearly enough.
Whoa. How does this relate to the Federalist Society?
Well, it's all a product of the Federalist Society. The idea of the Federalist Society was that we need to come up with talking points that we convince our judges to go along with. Scalia's Exhibit A. Alito's Exhibit A, Clarence Thomas's Exhibit A of the product of the Federalist Society. This is the kind of judges the Federalist Society.
So the Federalist
creates.
Society is to judges what Alec is to state legislators.
You got it. What's interesting about this case is why they're doing this. Why would a court, and this is being paid for by Exxon and Google and Walmart and, half a dozen petroleum companies. Why are they doing it? They're doing it because they're saying the pension program is costing the state or the municipality too much, and we would rather have that money for our tax breaks. We would rather have that money for our subsidies. So take it away from the fireman or the teacher or the policeman who's earned that pension program and give it to us by way of subsidies. And if they can convince these judges that they should go home and destroy these sacred pension programs that have been, look, most of these government workers, they worked for a lot less money so they can have this pension. That's part of the compensation package. But what this does, Tom, is it allows the oil companies, it allows Walmart to make more money in subsidies because there's more money to go around for them.
Wow. Plus, it if you can do away with public pensions, it relieves the pressure on private employers to offer pensions or retirement programs.
Yeah, it does one other thing, too. It moves the money into a 401k, and then the Wall Street then gets to take their share of it. If you think about this, anytime you have this movement of money from the government to some type of Wall Street investor, whether it's a 401k. Anytime Wall Street gets a hand, their hand on that pension program, A, they don't make as much money for the pension holder as you would just if the pension holder just put that money in the S&P. I mean, the statistics are overwhelming.
Right.
When you take mom and pop's money, who might have earned this money as a fireman or a policeman, and you give it to Wall Street, A, the fees are huge. There's no need to pay those kind of fees. But B, they don't make as much money because Wall Street is either incompetent or they're simply trying to skim off more for themselves.
Well, it's like the casino. You know, the house always wins.
House always wins. Yeah. And this is another way to move the money to the house.
Yeah, amazing. Now, at the same time, the Roberts Supreme Court is largely since 2000, which preceded Roberts, of course, but largely since the Bush v. Gore decision, the standing of the court has just been collapsing in the minds of the American people. Does this open opportunities for us to, you know, harass our legislators into using Article 3, Section 2 options to regulate the court, or even better, to pass a constitutional amendment just explicitly saying that money is not found in the First Amendment and corporations are not found in the 14th?
I think the only way to solve the court problem, Tom, is to put term limits. You can't have a guy like Scalia around the court for as many years as he's been there. And the influence and impact he has on democracy is, first of all, it's abominable. The impact he's had has been horrible.
Philip Schlafly would have said about Earl Warren.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. And the question is, do we have to give him lifetime appointments anyway? Why is it that we give him lifetime appointments? Look, you have the best example I give you, Citizens United. Now, understand, most of the public is low information where it comes to the intricacies of politics. But when they did a poll on this, 80% of the American public said that Citizens United was a bad idea. But add to that, what kind of impact did Citizens United have on the importance and distinction of this court? Well, it destroyed it. You have over 60% of the American public who say, you know what, these people have become politicos. We've talked about this before. All they are, Tom, all Alito is or Roberts is or Thomas, all they are is politicians who made it far enough along, put a black robe on, and now they have this mythical credibility. Yeah. We assume for some reason, because if you put a black robe on this guy or this woman, that they're somehow mythically brilliant, that they have some greater insight. I have 10 lawyers in this law firm that are better qualified on paper, honest to God, better qualified on paper than at least that majority of Supreme Court judges that are making all these horrible decisions.
Sure.
So we have to be realistic about who these people
wouldn't
are.
Wouldn't term limits, though, require a constitutional amendment? Doesn't Article 3, Section 1 say...
Yes, it does. It does. It's the only way you can get at it is a constitutional amendment because for some reason the drafters built in this,
The option that FDR proposed was
increase the number.
Well, it wasn't. It was what he said was every justice over the age of 70 in aggregate becomes one vote. They all become justices emeritus.
Yeah.
And there were five guys on the court at that time who were over 70. So the court would have expanded. He would have been able to appoint four more. But if nobody over 70 had been on the court, they wouldn't have expanded the size of the court. That's a way around amending the Constitution. You can do that legislatively.
Scared the hell out of them, didn't it?
It did. In 1937, they started dancing his song. Okay, Mike Papatonio, it's great talking with you. As always, Pap, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
We'll be right back. 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I love it. This the topic here that Pap sent us. It says, stop drinking Coke. KOCH. We'll be back. And welcome back. Mike Pacmentonio is still with us. I've had too much coffee today, Pam. I'm sorry. So you've got Ring of Fire Radio on the weekends, but you also have Ring of Fire TV every Sunday at noon right here on Free Speech TV, and then replays throughout the week, and people can check that out both at ringoffireradio.com and at freespeech.org. So what's coming up this weekend?
I've got Howard Nation's going to be talking about how Walmart has become the premier welfare queen. You are not going to believe the numbers, the welfare relief we have given Walmart. Again, not very often talked about. David Haynes is going to talk about the growing problems of overseeing what the pharmaceutical industry is doing, because there's more and more information coming out almost weekly where they're phonying up results of tests, they're hiding results, and then once the FDA gets it, they then start lobbying the FDA by doing things like becoming their buds and promising them jobs. It's more than just the revolving door. A revolving door is an understatement.
In fact,
there's
something I wanted to ask you about that. I had somebody call the show the other day, and you know, from time to time I get calls from people who I think are lobbyists. And this was one. This guy says, you know, there's legislation before Congress, or there should be, I forget which it was, to say that if you are terminal, then you have the right to try any damn experimental drug you want, as long as a pharmaceutical company will make it available to you. And in other words, do away with these stage 1, 2, 3, and 4 trials that the FDA has mandated. And, you know, in principle, it sounds great. You know, hey, here's a life raft that may or may not work. 5% chance is better than nothing. But my initial response was, I remember when these drug companies were testing some of these drugs and people in India and Bangladesh and got busted a decade or so ago for it and killed thousands of people. And it would just be a new way to turn Americans into guinea pigs. They could do it here. It'd be a lot cheaper. What do you think?
Where's this coming from? Well, the other part of it, Tom, I just took a deposition in New York last week on a company. It was a product called Pradaxa that's killing people by the hundreds throughout the United States, causing them to bleed to death. And, you know, as I look at what happened with that case, not only did they phony up the material, but they put it on a fast track. And it was completely unnecessary to be on a fast track. It's a blood coagulant. There are a dozen other blood coagulants.
This is the stuff that's marketed instead of warfarin, which my dad took in his later years.
That's exactly right. But the point I'm making here is what you're going to find, they're going to be, this one was put on a fast track. And it was completely a political favor that was done by putting it on a fast track with things like cancer drugs and mostly cancer drugs that really matter. And so that's the way it's going to end up being abused. That's why the pharmaceutical wants to get there. That's why this character that you were talking to says, hey, you know, it should be the wild, wild west where it comes to these drugs that where people are dying and chronically ill. So that's what will happen. I'm going to have Dave Tissell with us along with next week talking about the Koch brothers and how they're going about buying judges, kind of an extension of what we just talked about. Thomas Frank's going to be with us this week and talking about how the Clinton image, there's this huge effort to reinvent the Clinton image as being a man of the people. And what's interesting, Thomas Frank goes behind the story and shows us really how much damage Bill Clinton did to the American economy by these great deals he made with Wall Street.
And how rich he got doing it.
I mean, and how rich he got.
Guy's worth $100 million now, and I don't think he's ever had a job over it. Anyway, Pat, Mike Papantonio. Pat, thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank
Ring
you
of Fire TV, noon Eastern Time, right here on Free Speech TV. Check it out. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. And this is interesting. Bethany in Chicago wanted to talk about the THC ministry and Roger Christie. I confess ignorance about this. Christie, welcome. Or Bethany, welcome to the program. Bethany? Okay, I'm going to put Bethany back on hold here because I think she's listening to her radio and not her TV. And let's try Derek in Denver, listening on AM 760. Hey, Derek, you wanted to disagree with me in my assertion that having a government official on a government payroll in a government-paid-for facility open a meeting with a prayer is a violation of the First Amendment.
Yeah, it couldn't come at a more convenient time after Papantonio just got done speaking, which, by the way, you know, you should call him when he makes assertions. Go to his website and look at the bios of his lawyers. There's very few or even from a top 50 law school, let alone 10 of them that could beat the qualifications of any Supreme Court.
Doesn't make somebody a bad lawyer.
What's that? Well, he said on paper he has 10 lawyers that would beat anyone.
Yeah, I'm willing to believe him. You think that what makes somebody a good lawyer is that their daddy went to Harvard so they can get into Harvard?
He said on paper. On paper means qualifications, resume, and things like
right.
that.
Derek, this is a debate you're going to have to take up with Pap. I don't know his lawyers. I don't know his law firm, and I can't.
Yeah, well, that's fine. Hey, well, go look.
You had a debate to pick up. You had a bone to pick with me. Go for it.
Yeah, I did. You know, I'm basically a libertarian at mind, but the biggest problem with you guys on the left, which is anytime you think something is bad, you think it should be unconstitutional.
That's not true. I can give you a long list of things I think are bad that are not in the Constitution.
Well, okay, how do you explain the fact that almost every single person who drafted the Constitution not only participated and endorsed the hiring of a chaplain for Congress, they almost all of them had prayers before their state and government meetings when they were there. Now, you're going to say, oh, it's a living document and blah, 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 blah. But that's just an excuse to twist the Constitution to anything you want.
Actually, I would suggest you go back and read James Madison's papers. There were lots and lots and lots of meetings that did not open with any kind of prayer.
I was a faculty member at a law school. I know what I'm talking about. And the other thing is...
Was it top 50?
You know, what's that?
Was it top 50?
Yes.
Okay.
Actually.
All right.
Top 20, if you want to know.
Okay.
But I'd be glad to talk to you offline about it because, you know, you people...
That's fine. I'll take your word for it.
People come out here all the time and just distort. You know, just like you do with Citizens United. Say, well, money isn't speech. Well, that's just absolutely wrong. I mean, the judges that are politicians almost exclusively, not exclusively, but almost exclusively come from the left. Because unless you're willing to say that the Congress should be able to regulate the budget that the New York Times spends on political reporting, if you're comfortable with that, then you're consistent. But otherwise, it's just basically, oh, gee, God forbid we should have a company other than a left-leaning media company being able to have free speech.
You're not making any sense here, Derek. I'm sorry.
Okay, so do you think that the Congress could regulate the amount of money that the New York Times spends on political point reporting?
Broadly, no. Why?
Well, then why can they regulate how much other companies spend on their political activities?
Well, because political reporting and political advocacy are two different things. If you had asked, do I think Congress should have the right to regulate how much the New York Times can spend on political advocacy under cover of being the press, I would argue that sort of like, you know, the doctrine of piercing the corporate veil, that would be the point at which the New York Times ceases to be the press and no longer enjoys protections under the First Amendment.
So you probably think that Congress should be able to regulate what Fox News reports because you think that they're advocating for right-wing and...
No, what I said in no way leads...
And who judges what's, quote, political? If the New York Times constantly takes a left-wing point of view, constantly endorses, they endorse candidates.
Right.
Constantly endorses candidates as 95% of their
right, as the press has done since the founding of the Republic. Yeah.
What's that?
As the press has done since the founding of the Republic.
As what press has done?
As the press has done since the founding of the Republic. We've had newspapers
right,
endorsing candidates since the founding of this Republic.
Right, and we've had prayer in front of public meetings since the founding of the Republic, too. So,
you're right.
So you can use, there's a perfect example of how you guys think.
And yet, in 1907, Congress passed a law, the Tillman Act, which made it a federal crime for a corporation to give money to a politician who is running for federal office. And that stood until Citizens United.
Yeah.
And you're trying to tell me that Citizens United, you know, which struck down literally 103 years of law, of law passed by we the people, that was not, you know, those judges were not behaving as if they were politicians?
How many years of law did Roe versus Wade struck down? How many years of law did...
At the federal level? None that I know of. I don't know that there were any...
How many years of accepted common law and accepted state law did Roe versus Wade and Brown versus.
Well, let me give you my opinion on Roe.
Also 100 years.
No, there were, to the best of my knowledge, yeah. I may be wrong on this, and correct me if I am, and give me the citation, but I don't know that there were any federal regulations against abortion in 73. A and B, I think that Roe v. Wade was wrongly decided. I think when the Supreme Court established the doctrine of three trimesters, that they wrote law. And that's not the job of the Supreme Court. I find that nowhere in the Constitution.
Well, the original wrong case was the predecessor of that, which found a mythical right to privacy in the Ninth Amendment. But that overturned, you know, almost 150 years of accepted law.
Which case was that?
The Connecticut.
You're talking about Griswold in Connecticut?
Yeah.
About contraception?
Yeah.
But that was within your own home. I mean, okay, Derek, we'll have to live to fight another day. We're out of time.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
But I love debating the law. Give me a call back next week. We'll be back. Good, the bad, and the very, very orexigenically ugly, the good. Stanford University. Earlier this week, the university took a big step toward a greener future. After taking the input of students, faculty, and alumni, its board of trustees voted to divest the school's endowment from the coal industry, making Stanford the first big-name university to do so. Stanford's president, John Hennessy, said that the move is totally in line with his school's belief that it has a responsibility as a global citizen to promote sustainability for our planet. It won't be easy to transition to a sustainable future, but it's the only way we can stop global warming. Good on Stanford, setting a great example of how we can move toward a world without fossil fuels. The bad. Martha McCollum. Just a day after the White House released a report concluding that climate change is already happening and about to get a whole lot worse, the Fox News host appeared on fellow Fox pundit Brian Kilmeade's radio show to offer this nugget of wisdom.
I mean, the climate has changed over the course of the thousands and thousands of years that the Earth's been in existence. It has changed, you know, by several degrees up and down over the course of it. I just don't think that there's convincing evidence that the presence of man has altered that more dramatically than, say, the Earth being covered with volcanoes emitting, you know, naturally noxious gases.
So you're saying that it's cyclical. Brian wouldn't even go that far, by the way.
I'm saying that it's nature.
Oh, this is just flat out wrong. While there is such a thing as natural climate change, 97% of scientists agree that, based on their very detailed research, the type of climate change we're seeing right now is the direct result of humans burning fossil fuels. In most of the world, this is just accepted as fact, but thanks to people like Martha McCollum, many Americans, by some estimates as many as 23%, still don't believe in climate change. And the very, very ugly, Representative Devin Nunes. During an interview published in Politico this morning, the California Republican accused Michigan Congressman Justin Amash, who's a big supporter of NSA reform, of being in league with terrorists. Nunes says he's been leading the charge and not telling the truth about NSA surveillance policies, and it gets to the point where my assessment is this is a guy willing to work with San Francisco Democrats to protect baked fish, and at the same time, he's Al-Qaeda's best friend in Congress. That's right. Congressman Nunes thinks trying to stand up for constitutional liberties makes you Al-Qaeda's best friend. That is very, very ugly. And this is a Republican trashing a Republican, by the way. Justin Amash is a Republican, if my recollection is correct. Maybe I'm wrong on that, but I don't think so. I think he's a Republican from Michigan. Anyway, Caitlin, in LaGrange, Illinois. Hey, Caitlin, what's up?
Hey there. So after hearing about the decision to let public leaders open meetings with prayer, I'm, of course, worried about, just all the regular arguing against fundamentalism and how taxing that is for us. But I wonder if perhaps we might respond to that by opening meetings maybe with pieces of literature or art or secular kind of humanist ideas.
Dance, song?
You know, I don't expect it to get too animated, and I hope, honestly, that it's the effect eventually would be to mitigate the need for people to open public meeting with ideological statements of any kind, right. Because hopefully the fact that people are meeting publicly to discuss policies together is in and of itself a pretty great ideological statement. But I would love to see, if it gets out of hand, you know, some great Kurt Vonnegut quotes or the likes.
Yeah.
At the beginnings of these things.
Well, that's good guerrilla theater, too. My, you know, you raise an interesting point, since we're getting together to discuss public policy, and that public policy may involve religion. It might be, you know, are we going to change zoning for this church, or are we going to give a tax exemption to this particular religious organization or recognize their tax-exempt status, or are we going to, provide school buses for this parochial school, those kinds of things. In that case, I think that you could build a strong argument that opening with a prayer is actually biasing the entire event, which is another argument for not doing that. Caitlin, may I give you a certificate for some free flowers from ProFlowers for Mother's Day?
That sounds really nice. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Hang on. I'm going to put you on hold. Thanks for listening to WCPT. Caitlin is on line two, Danielle. And which takes us to Bethany in Chicago. Hey, Bethany, what's up?
Oh, thank you for taking my call. I'm glad you brought up the dangers of designer drug hallucinogens, HPPD, and flashbacks, and a drug being unregulated. How much dangerous it could be?
Yeah, I didn't, but I agree with that. It's a whole different world than it was in 1967.
I also wanted to bring up that you have heard of THC Ministries when you interviewed Reverend Roger Christie before his arrest in 2010.
Oh, that was years ago.
Yeah, he's still in prison.
This was the guy, he was out of Hawaii, wasn't he?
Hawaii, yes. He's also co-founder of Hawaiian Hemp Council.
Right.
And you know, hemp industry is also very important. The petrodollar desecrating Malula or Syria or putting Christians in danger in the Middle East, maybe it is very Christian. I mean, yeah. It's very sad to see the destruction.
Yeah, good point.
That petrodollar has caused.
Good point. Thank you for the reminder, and my apologies for having forgotten Roger Christie. I am terrible with names, unless they're historical figures, and even then I have a rough time with them. But I do remember that interview with him, and I'm sorry to hear that he's still in prison. Thank you for the update on that. Bethany, thank you, and thanks for listening to WCPT. Larry, watching Free Speech TV on cable system in Newcastle, Maine. What's up, Larry?
It's not Larry, it's Lynn.
Oh, Lynn. I'm sorry.
Maine.
Yeah. See, I need to get my eyes, my glasses checked here. It's
this whole thing's been kind of transcendental because we lose you after the first hour on public access. So I'm listening on a landline phone for this.
Oh,
whole time.
Okay.
I thought I might be a non sequitur at this point, but you had in the first hour the elderly gentleman, a little elderly more than me, about progressive Christianity,
mm-hmm.
and I can tell you the book.
Okay.
Because he mentioned the name John Shelby Spong,
mm-hmm.
who is a minister, and he's written many books, but I just read the one Jesus for the Non-Religious, wherein he takes on a lot of the material from the Jesus Project that was in the 1980s.
Right, Funk and Pagels and those folks.
Yes, and this premise, Reverend Spong's premise, is that Christianity, perhaps like the other world religions, doesn't work anymore because it doesn't fit what's happened with our culture. And using the materials that have basically dissected how the New Testament was put together and who the authors were or weren't and might have been, and what actually is the core of Christianity, which I think Jefferson was looking for when he wrote his Bible, that we've made God far too small in the face of quantum physics and quantum mechanics, and that we've reduced God to a personal level, which Reverend Spong and others believe is not possible.
Well, that's interesting. So there, basically the premise is the way that we now view the old Norse religions or the Roman and Greek religions, where everything had a god, you know, lightning and this, that, and the other thing. And we view that as a quaint misunderstanding of nature, that he's suggesting that the Christian and presumably Jewish and Muslim, characterizations of divinity are equally small.
Yes, I think he'd agree with that premise, because if it's a God that runs the universe, we can't even conceive that.
Right.
And that the books of the New Testament that were written long after Jesus was dead, and mostly not by the people whose names are attached to them,
Right. But
people that we do not know, were fitting onto the culture of the time and the problems they had at the time and the internecine warfare they had at the time, and that all of this was shuffled together 300, 400, 500 years after all the events in order to produce what we now see as Christianity. So the people who want to open meetings, public meetings, I go to New England town meetings, with prayers here, I really is... talk about non sequitur, it really isn't what those religions started out to be, and it has accreted many growths on top of it and condensed God down to where we can identify with him, her,
as a person. It's all about the anthropomorphization of something that is unanthropomorphic. Promorphizable.
A great source of scholarship that you can read are the books of Bart Ehrman, Ehrman, who now declares himself an atheist. And Dr. Spong Spong has a website, so if you want to look up.
I'll have to check it out. Lynn, thank you for the heads up and for the information. I appreciate it. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I wonder what Jesus would pray before a public meeting. Just wonder. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Kathy, watching Free Speech TV in Watsonville, California, on the Dish TV network. Kathy, you're on the air. What's up? Kathy? I'm sorry, Kathy. I can't hear you. Alan in Pierpont, Ohio. Hey, Alan. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Well, first of all, happy birthday, Tom. Happy belated birthday.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
And the fellow that called in and was talking about the left and referring to us as those people or you people, I would like to express to them that they think money is speech. If my money starts talking to me, I would seek psychiatric help.
Yeah, and Scalia should too.
I would talk about is the evangelistic movement in the military. And they're using the military as a vehicle to spread their beliefs across the world. And I was wondering what your uptake on that would be.
Mikey, what was his last name? A fellow by his first name is Mikey. He exposed maybe 4 or 5 years ago the Air Force Academy, the Christian bullies at the U.S. Air Force Academy, and how it was being used to proselytize aggressively proselytize and punish people who didn't declare fundamentalist Christianity. His son, he was Jewish, and his son was in the Air Force Academy. And he came out about this. He was a minor media celebrity for a few months. He was on our program a couple times. And, then, of course, there was the sexual scandals around the Air Force Academy. But I haven't heard much about that recently. But I know that the evangelical groups are very aggressively active in our military. Mikey Weinstein. That's his name. Thank you, Shana. We should see if Mikey Weinstein is still around and get him back on the program and see what he's up to these days. But I think that evangelism in the military is a big problem. Okay. Thank you, Alan, for the call. Good to hear from you. Corky in Hilton, New York. Hey, Corky, what's up? Thanks for watching.
Yeah, hello. You and Mike are late to the party, but we'll take your code and let you in anyways.
Okay.
These trade agreements, there's not been one in the history of the United States that's ever benefited the middle-class worker.
I agree.
You know, and these people who complain about unions, when the air traffic controllers were fired, all us union employees were screaming. Nobody came to our rescue.
Yep.
Then they came after the truck drivers. Now they're coming after the teacher. And everybody's sitting on their hands. And that's why your wages are dropping. Because the unionization and my union dues accounted for 85% of the wage standards in this country. Now they're gone. And you guys are all sitting on your hands wondering what happened.
Yeah, well, I'm not. But, yeah, I get your point. I get your point. It's, you know, Reagan declared war on labor in 1981, and that war on labor has been unrelenting, unremitting, and unstopped, and not even seriously modulated since he declared it, and it's continuing to this very day. And it's well-financed, it's powerfully backed, and it ain't going away. Corky, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. We'll be back. It's 10 minutes before the end. Before the hour, so let's the second hour of our program, so let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by Goats for the Old Goat.com, and also from the effort to free an American political prisoner, former Alabama Governor Don Siegelman, free-don.org. Let's check in with Bob Ney, author of Sideswiped, brilliant book about what's going on here in Washington, D.C. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Hello, Tom. How are you?
I am fine, thank you. What's going on in the world?
Well, there's a lot going on. You know, of course, there's the Benghazi hearings and the debate that's simmered within the ranks on the Democratic side internally, which is whether to appoint or not appoint. And Leader Pelosi had said she was leaning against appointing at one point in time. But then Henry Waxman, very obviously well-respected outgoing congressman from California on the Democratic side, has said you need to appoint, get some good people on there, and go to combat.
Yeah, so basically the debate is, do we do what Elijah Cummings is doing on the, what's the House Oversight Committee? On Daryl Issa's committee, and just every time Daryl Issa says something stupid, Elijah Cummings jumps up and says, that's stupid, metaphorically speaking. And do we do that, or do we just boycott the entire thing and let the Republicans have their kangaroo court?
I would think that...
As a former member of Congress, what do you think is the wisest way to go?
Put the best and the brightest on the committee.
Yeah.
Absolutely, from the Democratic side. I predict to you that Leader Pelosi will do that. I mean, I don't have any inside information.
Kick ass.
And good ones. I mean, don't make this where, hey, I need this because I'm up for election. No,
yeah.
Which is how people get on committees.
Right.
She needs to appoint very, very good people, articulate people that can really get in there. And because this is the last hurrah, Tom. And, you know, John Boehner knows that. He resisted doing this and for some reason has now done it to play to the base.
She needs to put Alan Grayson on this committee.
He's in trouble. Wow.
Don't you think?
Yeah, well, you need people that can go to combat.
Alan Grayson, he'll go to the mattresses. I mean, you know, remember his, here's the Republican health plan. Don't get sick, number one. Number two, if you do get sick, die quick. They freaked out, but they had no response. I mean, he's so good at guerrilla theater. He would be I would love to see Alan Grayson on that committee.
You need people like that. I mean, we had J.D. Hayworth used to be in Congress, quick wit.
Oh, yeah.
If you had to go in the trenches, you wanted J.D. versus somebody that just sits there and kind of stares at you.
Oh, he was on my show a couple times. He went on to become a talk show host, or else he started as one or the other
way. And very artistic. So I think that they need to do that, and they would need to do that, you know, fairly quick. The learner in contempt vote, which six Democratic members went along with it, but that was it. That is amazing, because then the follow-up question is, what do you do after this? Do you actually drag her into a D.C. jail and lock her up? You know,
right.
Where does this go?
Well, does the police authority of the Capitol Police, who answer to the members of Congress, extend outside the Capitol building?
No, they have jurisdiction within six blocks of the Capitol. It's also done in conjunction with Metro D.C. So technically, unless she walked, you know, into the Capitol area,
right, within six blocks,
it would be very difficult to get her. They'd have to have a specific vote that she is to be arrested. A second vote.
Yeah, I think all they're looking for is the soundbite. You know, this is just all about trying to convince, certainly Fox viewers, but I think they're trying to go beyond that, to convince Americans that the Obama administration is corrupt, that there was a scandal that involved the IRS and conservative groups. All the evidence now indicates that there wasn't, and that there is something or was something shady going on with regard to Benghazi. And
well, you know, the next step, too. This officially now that's had its vote goes on to Eric Holder. So the next step is going to be the Republicans to, you know, say that Eric Holder needs to step down again because, of course, they had a contempt vote on him. But he needs to step down because he's, quote, not doing anything. And the reality of this, which a lot of people just aren't aware of, somehow it escaped a lot of scrutiny, there was a deal being cut because there are statements she had made, and you look at them, it's time references which are made into a big deal. Well, you said December of 2011, it was January of 2012, you know. And in order to protect herself, she took the fifth, maybe technically in an incorrect way is what they're saying, but the fact remains that there was a deal being cut for her to have some immunity, and they could ask her anything she wanted. That was blown by Congressman Issa because he went and ranted against her publicly, and that blew that deal. That's a fact.
Was that a mistake?
And that was a huge mistake on his part, or he did it intentionally to make sure she had to continue to invoke the fifth. I don't know if he's that smart, but
yeah, I don't know what there is that, you know, behind all this. It seems like all of the evidence is, I mean, who is the group who just did this, the FOIA filing, and they discovered that more progressive groups had been targeted for scrutiny than conservative groups by the IRS?
Well, on this issue, it's the IRS's job to, you know, it's the IRS's job to scrutinize groups.
Right, right.
That's what they're supposed to do.
Yeah.
Because is the group political or it's not political, et cetera.
Right.
And I think more filings were made by conservative groups.
There was more greater scrutiny of liberal groups. There was a big headline to that effect, but it only lasted for a day or two. It was a couple of weeks ago. Anyhow, what else is going on in the world, Bob?
Well, there's that. The Nigeria situation. It's to be seen whether this, you know, the head of this group, which I had never heard of, maybe you had known about it, Boko Haram.
Right.
It's to be seen whether he's really trying to extort the release of prisoners out of the Nigerian government, and because he hasn't killed the girls, thank goodness, but, you know, he's maybe got an agenda down there. Of course, America has sent some assistance, our law enforcement and some, you know, people to try to help, but it's to be seen, you know, what he'll do to the Nigerian government. And the only other thing is they're asking the head of the Veterans Administration to come in and explain, you know, what he's doing.
Yeah, Bernie's asked him to appear before him in the Senate, too.
Yes, and he will go.
Yeah, of course.
Like that.
That'll be interesting. Bob Ney with the Talk Radio News Service, author of the brilliant book Sideswiped, which will really tell you things about Washington, D.C. that will curl your hair. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
Good talking with you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back to the third hour of our program. Tom Hartmann here with you, and had some interesting conversations here throughout the day. Susan Galloway was with us in our first hour. She was the litigant in the Supreme Court case of Greece v. Galloway. So we've been having a pretty fascinating conversation about, you know, what is free speech, what constitutes prayer, at what point are we establishing a religion by having elected officials make prayers or sponsor prayers before meetings and things like that. Are banksters responsible for autism? I haven't gotten into that yet. I should. Mike Papantonio dropped by. Was talking about the Koch brothers and this pension reform seminar for judges. Just a whole bunch of very, very interesting things going on. And right now, Paul DiRienzo is with us. He's an independent journalist working under a grant from the George Polk Awards, and he's investigating the Hanford nuclear site. His Twitter is P. DiRienzo, DiRienzo, P. DiRienzo. Paul, welcome.
Thank you, Tom. Really nice to be here.
Thank you for joining us. So there was a pipe explosion at the Hanford. First of all, let's explain to everybody what the Hanford nuclear site is.
Sure. The Hanford nuclear site was one of the crown jewels of the Manhattan Project. And later on it was used. I'm sorry, I'm hearing an echo. It's sort of thank you very much. And the Hanford site was part of the Manhattan Project, and it was specifically the part of the Manhattan Project that was used to produce plutonium. And plutonium is a transuranic element, a man-made discovered element that is used, pretty much its only real use, 99.9% of its use is to make the most powerful explosives humanly possible, and it was used to make the bomb that was dropped on Nagasaki and also for the Trinity test bomb. So those were plutonium-fueled weapons. And then it later on made about two-thirds of all the plutonium that was produced in the United States military apparatus during the Cold War.
And it's also the most toxic substance on Earth. I remember back in the 70s when John Goffman was getting the committee, the Union of Concerned Scientists going, writing a piece about how one cup or one, maybe it was 1 pound, and they might be the same thing, of plutonium, if evenly distributed around the planet, would be enough to kill every human on Earth, because basically one particle inhaled is almost inevitably going to lead to cancer within the next decade.
Yeah, it's a alpha emitter. So actually, plutonium is interesting in that you could probably hold it in your bare hand and it would feel warm, and that would not kill you because the alpha particles could not penetrate your skin. But if one minuscule particle of it were to actually be inhaled into your body, there's models you can see on the internet. There's plenty on various sites. You can see the models where one tiny piece of plutonium irradiates literally hundreds of thousands of cells around it constantly and incessantly year after year after year. And the radiation, when it almost has an affinity radiation in general for DNA. It just seems to be, for some reason that's not fully understood, attracted into human DNA and where it damages the DNA. And cancer is definitely one of those possible outcomes. Interesting to note that the reason we know that radiation causes cancer is because humans and our medical establishment has an interest in cancer being a terrible disease, and we know more about it than many of the diseases that that affect humans, and therefore we don't really know all the things that radiation does to people.
Yeah, yeah. The for example, the kidney disease and whatnot. But in any case, and that particle of plutonium could be as small as a single atom. Right. So we've established what plutonium is and what the Hanford nuclear site was. It's still there. What's going on there?
It's 560 square miles. Its height had nine reactors, nine major plutonium-producing reactors operating until 1987, when the last reactor was shut down. Similar to the Chernobyl reactor, after Chernobyl occurred, there was a tremendous outcry in this country, and finally they shut down the last reactor. In 1986, a reporter for the Spokane A review newspaper got a Freedom of Information Act and was able to find out, get 19,000 pages of classified documents released. And for the first time in 1986, was the first time America knew really what was going on at Hanford, truly what was going on. And we still don't know only a small part of it, but hundreds of thousands of documents have been released since then, and we still only know a little bit about what happened there. And now the cleanup begins. And the cleanup will take, right now it's being pursued along the riverfront where they've closed down the reactors. They cannot be fully demolished for 75 years. It takes that long for the radiation to die down. That's one part of it. The radioactive tons, millions of cubic feet of low activity waste, 50, 60 million gallons of high radioactive waste that's in tanks hidden under the ground there for decades, 40 years, way beyond the lifespan of the tanks, what they were designed for, 20 years now, it's been 40, 50 years or more. They're leaking. Over a million gallons have been admitted to, but much more than that is leaked. There is radiation, even to this day, leaking into the river, leaking into the air, leaking into the ground.
And wait a second. If these are plants that are designed to produce plutonium, presumably plutonium is part of what's leaking?
Every single compound known to man.
Wow.
Every element, every compound, every radioactive ever devised is in that soup, and that's why it's been so difficult to clean up. At Savannah River, the cleanup has gone much quicker. But at Hanford, they have serious, serious problems with the cleanup because they just don't know what to do with the chemicals. And it's not just radioactive chemicals. There's other chromium, many, many, many toxic, tritium, which is radioactive, but there's many, many toxic chemicals, and many of them are not well understood, and they've been leaching into the environment now for close to 70 years.
Wow. Now, recently there was a pipe explosion there. Do I have this right?
Yes, that's the most recent one. It seems like every month or so there's another leak or disaster. A couple of months ago, it was one of the double shell tanks, which were supposed to not be leaking, was discovered to have been leaking. This explosion that happened, we didn't hear about it until several weeks, 14 days after the explosion. It was a small little pop, which of course might have released plutonium because it happened in the plutonium finishing plant, which was the factory building that was used to actually machine the plutonium before it was sent out to Los Alamos to be fixed into a bomb. And so there's plutonium everywhere. It's you discovered it sometimes by accident. They opened a safe once that was found in a garbage dump, and inside the safe was a bottle of liquefied plutonium.
Wow.
Had been there since 1945 and been forgotten about.
And the half-life of plutonium is something like a quarter of a billion years or something, isn't it?
The half-life is 24,000 years, and 10 times the half-life is how long it's dangerous. So it's dangerous for 240,000 years. Other substances are probably more dangerous as they have more of a direct effect on our health, or strontium and cesium. Strontium 90, cesium, both are calcium analogs. They're just like calcium to the body, and so the body tends to put them right into your bones.
Right.
So your bones.
Well, cesium, doesn't the body think the cesium is potassium?
I believe calcium.
And so it goes into the muscles?
That might be as well, too. Yeah. I mean, these are similar. It's a small group of elements that are involved in life, the life cycle.
Right.
And when these other elements get into the body and the body thinks they're the worst is iodine, which has a relatively short half-life of 8 days. So in 1945 to early 1950s, a huge amount of iodine was released, some of it by the government on purpose as part of human experimentation over the entire state of Washington, in which hundreds of thousands of people were purposely dosed with radioactive iodine.
Hmm.
And those came out in the documents. And that was done on numerous occasions right up into the 1960s or later, for all we know. And there were several books on the subject. Extensive experimentation on humans was done.
Amazing stuff. Paul DiRenzio,
DiRienzo. DiRienzo.
DiRienzo. Thank you very much.
P. DiRienzo is my my Twitter handle.
P. DiRienzo. Thank you. Thank you, Paul. Thanks so much for sharing the information with us.
Thank you.
And for the great investigative reporting you're doing. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
This is pretty bizarre stuff. It's quite bizarre stuff. It ain't good. We'll be back. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And John in Seattle listening on KBCS. Hey, John, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I apologize that the first call you're getting taking after that discussion to Hanford, I would like to talk about religious freedom.
No, the stuff we were talking about in the previous hours. That's fine. Sure.
Thanks very much. The thing that I've been studying and learning about for the last month is that sort of there are two things going on. One is we don't understand how hard won religious tolerance has been. When the Constitution was passed, there were established churches in most states. In 1811, the New York State Supreme Court upheld a conviction for blasphemy, which is an example of hard state establishment. That is to say,
right.
You know, knuckle under to the religious forces or we will convict you.
Right.
The last state established church was disestablished in 1833. And the thing I take from this...
Which state was that? What church was it? Do you know?
I don't remember. That's okay. I get from Robert Boston, his new book, Taking Liberties.
Okay.
Why religious freedom doesn't give you the right to tell other people what to do. And I just flat out do not remember.
That's
what
fine.
Stuck in my mind, though, is that... I think it's reasonable to think of religious tolerance and freedom as being monotonically increasing since the founding, that it was a hard principle to establish. It took 100 years for something called incorporation to mean that the U.S. Constitution was incorporated into state constitutions and that the rights guaranteed in the federal constitution were also guaranteed to those of us in a state.
Right.
And
it took the Civil War for that to happen.
Bingo. It exactly. And okay. Since in my lifetime, you know, we've moved from blue laws where stores couldn't even open on Sunday and a world in a regime of censorship, which was acceptable and banned books and so forth. And to my way of thinking, the religious right has lost the power to coerce the rest of us over the last 200 years, which is what the anti-establishment clause would dictate.
Mm-hmm.
And so you then ask yourself, you know, what's happening? And over the last 20 years, and this I get out of a not bad piece today by a gal named Catherine Stewart, who's apparently spent a lot of her life looking into issues like this and has published on, for example, the subject of the religious right trying to...
John, just a half a minute left here. Get to your point.
Got it. And the thing that I learned from her is that there is a term we need to understand called soft establishment. And when Kennedy says to this Jew and this atheist that you're not discommoded by any of the speech that you're hearing, when we're told that, you know, unless we stand up and laud Jesus, we're somehow less than a really good community member, we are being marginalized, and it's part of the creation of the soft establishment. They want the acknowledgement that Christianity is the dominant religion, even though it's not actually established, even though we won't put you in jail if you fail to follow through. We want.
So this is the new reaction. These are the new reactionaries.
The last 20 years has been to establish not hard establishments, but soft.
Yeah, and I think that Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, Billy Graham led the charge. I'm with you, John. Well said. Thanks for the analysis. We'll be back. 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Steve in Chicago listening to WCPT. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Yes, I wanted to make a couple of points, especially with regard to your earlier caller who suggested that, first of all, he had a background in academia. I as well come from a background in academia. I hold a doctorate in political science. I belong to the American Political Science Association and have attended 7 out of the last 10 years conferences. And I will tell you that each and every one of the issues that he brought up has been addressed by some of the best minds in the field. And he is, quote unquote, the equivalent of a climate change denier in terms of his interpretation of the Constitution and its history and its role in modern society.
Okay, now just for people who might have just tuned in, this guy called in the previous hour and he said he was a former professor at a top 20 law school and went off on this thing about how whenever you liberals, you know, object to something, you say it's unconstitutional. And the thing that he was objecting to is the assertion in this most recent Supreme Court case, where we had Susan Galloway on as a guest in our first hour, the city of Greece, New York versus Galloway, that she should just buck it up. And, you know, this very, very fundamentalist Christian prayer, literally praying to Jesus and thanking him for dying on the cross for us, opening the city council meeting, that according to Justice Kennedy and the other four Catholics on the Sotomayor is also Catholic, but all five of them are Christians on the Supreme Court. That, you know, tough luck, Charlie. And he was attacking me basically for saying that
exactly.
I think this was wrongly decided.
And he illustrates a view which isn't by any means some sort of modern day interpretation. You know, this notion of a sort of fluid constitution. This is something that was expressed by numerous delegates to the Constitutional Convention when it came to enumerating the Bill of Rights, because many of them said, you know, if we make a list, and I'm paraphrasing, if we make a list of rights, sooner or later some idiot will come along and claim that we are entitled to no more rights than our...
Oh, that was Hamilton's argument. That was Madison's argument. Read the letters
exactly.
Between Madison and Jefferson. In the fall of 1787, you can fairly easily find these things online now. And you know, Madison, when he had the first draft of the Constitution, Jefferson was still in Paris. He sends it off to Paris and says, what do you think? Because Jefferson is his mentor, you know. And Jefferson sends it back saying, I like this. Now I will tell you what I do not like. That's a verbatim quote. And he said, what I do not like is that there is not an explicit Bill of Rights that, and then he goes through the things he wants in the Bill of Rights. He wants there to be no standing army during times of peace, no monopolies in commerce. Neither one of those things happened. The Second Amendment was sort of an attempt at the first. And that there's absolute and unremitting freedom of religion, freedom of the press, and freedom of speech. And I forget what the other thing was that he wanted, but he had this list, right? And that's where it began. And then Hamilton throws this, excuse me, then Madison throws this to Hamilton, and Hamilton comes back and says, no, there should not be a Bill of Rights, because if we have a Bill of Rights, then people will say that's all there is. And
absolutely.
And Jefferson ultimately won the argument, and he won the argument by threatening to pull Virginia out of the ratification of the Constitution if the agreement was not made to have a Bill of Rights. And, you know, it got very, very political there. Jefferson won. But there was a large contingent led by Hamilton and somewhat agreed to by Madison, although ultimately he went along with Jefferson, that there should not be a Bill of Rights because, as you said, future generations may say, and I've written several pieces about this. You could track down and you can find Jefferson and Hamilton and Adams' exact words on this. Future generations may say that our rights are limited to those enumerated in the Bill of Rights.
Oh, absolutely. And when, you know, you talk to people who are, you know, pro-life elements in this society, you know, they will tell you, where is the right to privacy in the Constitution? But yet, when you ask Americans, do you think you should have the right to the following in terms of privacy, your home, your body, all, yes, of course. We
right.
assume that that's a right that exists.
But right. And this guy who called was saying that Griswold was wrongly determined that this is where the court invented the right to privacy. And Griswold v. Connecticut back in the 60s or 50s, whenever it was, I think it was 65. It was at that point in time, there was a law in Connecticut that said that if you were a married couple and you had condoms in your bedroom, you could go to prison because birth control was illegal in Connecticut. And Griswold sued the state, and the Supreme Court ruled on behalf of Griswold saying, no, sorry, you have the right to privacy in your own home, which includes the right to having birth control devices like condoms. And he said the court just invented that right to privacy, which I think is nonsense. Back to you.
And my last point here, and I think it's an interesting one because it demonstrates the level of hypocrisy that exists amongst persons who are arguing for this strict constructionist view of the Constitution. Because, you know, the case of Barron versus Baltimore, in which the Supreme Court. These are individuals who are contemporaries of the Founding Fathers, just, right. You know, a few decades removed. Some of them actually knew the Founding Fathers. Basically said that the Constitution applies only to the federal government. Right. And so that, in other words, if the city of Chicago wants to make a law that denies you the freedom of speech, they can go ahead and do so. It wasn't until we evolved in terms of our interpretation of the Constitution to demand that even states must abide by those federal protections. So right. Guess what? The Constitution that protects you against the city in which you live and the state in which you live that can't prohibit your right to freedom of speech, that was an evolution. It was not intended in the original Constitution to apply to the state in which you live. But guess what? We've evolved. Or would you like to go back to the original version?
Yeah, or at least it was not enforced that way. I mean, there were certainly members of the Constitutional Convention and who felt that the protections of the Bill of Rights, for example, should be applied all the way down to the municipal level. But it wasn't until after the Civil War. I mean, the Civil War was a turning point, just like the ratification of the Constitution was. We went, under the Articles of Confederation, we had a very weak federal government. Then we went to a slightly stronger federal government under the Constitution. And then after the Civil War, we went to a very strong federal government and weak states.
And this is my last point. People, they are amendments, not commandments.
Yes.
I mean,
well said.
Let's try and remember that.
Well said. They're amendments, not commandments. Steve, thank you very much for a thoughtful, insightful analysis. We've had some great calls today. I love it. I learn as much from my callers as hopefully I've shared and taught over the years. We will be back with more. And we got some really good calls here. We'll be back with more later.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And again, I ask the question, what would Jesus, what would his prayer be to open a public meeting? There's a hint. It's talk media for the sane among us, fair and only slightly unbalanced. Tom Hartman here with you, and Joe in Chicago Heights, Illinois. Hey, Joe. We're going to talk about the Supreme Court ruling and flatulism.
As usual, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And I just wanted to address two things. One had to do with your talking about principles and some common issues regarding principles,
mm-hmm.
which I think actually the opposite is true, that creates a lot of the problems. And that when we're discussing things with people from other viewpoints, the problem is they often don't have principles or egocentric and narcissistic, and they go back and forth.
Well, a few are. I can't afford to pay for
social services.
Yeah.
We kept, and then they want to, but they don't want to cut military spending, and they want to give tax breaks to businesses.
Okay.
But so it's just very hard to argue with people when they don't run on principles. They just go back and forth depending on the issue and how they want the outcome to be.
Yeah, those would be, I don't disagree. And there have been people that we've had on the program who essentially are like that. And basically it's, they don't have a principle, they have a party, and their arguments are partisan. And there are both Republicans and Democrats who will do that. It's far more endemic in the Republican Party than the Democratic Party, I think, at this point in time, although there are some so-called conservadems who seem to be without principle, but with issue. But yeah, I don't disagree in general. My whole principles versus issues thing had to do with my discussion with Phyllis Schlafly the other day, who I think is a principled person whose principles some of which I agree with, and on the issues in almost every regard I disagree with, and yet. There are, but we've already had that conversation. You wanted to talk about the Supreme Court ruling?
Yes, I did, about the prayer and public meetings and that. As you said, there's a numerous amount of creative theatrics that are going to go along, but my initial reaction is to create the religion of fatulence or fatulism, and that everybody in unison spend 30 seconds to a minute making farting noises at every public meeting that they want to open up with prayer.
Right. The new sacrament. Yeah. It's methane. It's methane. There you go. Joe, a good one. Thank you very much for the call. Umberto in Hialeah, Florida. Hey, Umberto, what's up?
Well, Tom, you were asking for people's opinions as to what Jesus would actually say at an opening prayer. But
well, and I started to say at the very end, and I got stepped on by my own machine, there's a hint in the Sermon on the Mount. Back to you, Umberto. I'm guessing you know where that's going.
Yeah, I agree. The contents of the Sermon on the Mount would definitely take a big part of his prayer. But
no, it's the other way around. In the Sermon on the Mount, he says, do not pray in public. When you pray, go into your closet and close the door and pray in private, and God will hear you in private. But when you pray in public, God's not listening, and you're just doing it for your own damn ego. That's what he says in the Sermon on the Mount. So yeah, he would not open a public meeting with a prayer because he would say, because he said that's wrong.
You got me there. You got me there. Yeah. Good job for you. You got me there. But as a progressive Christian, what I would like to say is if he did open up a public prayer, right, he would remind us of two very important things. Number one, what he said before Pilate when he was being tried, and that is that my kingdom is not of this world.
Right.
And nowhere in the New Testament, which I believe is the heart of genuine Christianity, nowhere is there any justification for any particular religious group or political party to try to overpower the government and use its authority to establish a theocracy. There is no justification anywhere, not even by Jesus himself, for the establishment of a humanly led theocracy.
Agreed.
He knew what kind of corruption and oppression that would lead to. Number two, one time he said, you cannot serve God and money at the same time, because you will either love one and hate the other, or serve one and oppose the other. And in a country like ours, where the true religion is capitalism, with such a wealth-obsessed and profit-obsessed country such as ours, that is something that we need to be reminded of. If we truly are godly people, we cannot be obsessed with money and materialism and profit and look down and oppress the poor. So you got me there on the first one, Tom. That's true.
Yeah, in fact, let me add to that. You know, not only in the Sermon on the Mount did Jesus say never pray in public, and which is one of the reasons why I don't. And in fact, I'm even before a meal, I don't sit down and say, let's all say a prayer. I mean, if I'm going to say a prayer, I'll say it to myself. But number one, and in fact, when I was pastor of a church in Detroit, I found myself in a very uncomfortable position with regard to that. And used to talk about it a fair amount. This is back in the early 70s. But the number two is the one time when Jesus did pray in public was when he was in the Garden of Gethsemane before he was executed, and he was together with his disciples. And I encourage anybody who's interested in, you know, this kind of stuff to read it, because he actually says a prayer. But and basically what he's doing is he's entrusting his disciples to his Father, to his Heavenly Father. But he opens the prayer by saying, I know that you hear me, and the only reason I'm saying this out loud is for the benefit of the people here in the room. And which is consistent, absolutely consistent with what he said in Matthew 6 or 5, 5, 6 or 7 in the Sermon on the Mount, where he says, if you speak out loud, you're really just saying it for yourself and the people in the room. So anyhow, Umberto, I got to run along. We got a whole room, a board full of callers here. I appreciate the call. Rose in Flemington, New Jersey, listening at WBAI. Hey, Rose, what's up?
Hi. I was listening. I just got something the other day. There seems to be a German bishop who's written a book that the Pope has referred to as his new kind of spin cycle encyclopedia. Called, in Spanish, it's Misericordia, and it has to do with mercy.
Hmm.
Can I mention the name of the program? And
yeah, sure.
It was on WNYC. It's Brian Larry. He's on in the morning. It's really quite wonderful.
I'll have to check it out.
I expected that he might have grown up as a Catholic, as I have. And, it's just fascinating, when we're talking about money and we're talking about war and we're talking about leaking plutonium. The churches seem to have so little to do with Mother Earth.
Yeah.
The Blessed Virgin is good in one group and not in the other. There seems to be nobody on this planet, whether it's a Muslim or a Jainist or a Buddhist or this or that, who isn't always looking for some kind of, you know, scam of control. And listening to this old guy, and he had a very thick accent, this German bishop,
And of course, you know about the last pope's brother. He was implicated in a lot of foolishness. All of a sudden, Brian Lehrer says to him, "Oh, I guess you want mercy for the church now." Now, it seems that there's been some meetings going on where the Vatican has decided that, oh, well, no, you can't prosecute us because it should have been taken care of by the police.
Right.
In the various jurisdictions that these nasty things had happened.
Yeah, we're talking about the pedophile priest stuff.
Yeah, they've totally covered up their records and refused to cooperate. And then they wonder why they're not respected. And it just seems to be so consistent. There is no religion that doesn't have so much hypocrisy.
Yeah.
And it's really very sad.
Well, and beyond that, Rose, let me add, and as somebody who I've been to Rome, I met Pope John Paul II at his invitation. I was in Dharamsala and spent a week with His Holiness the Dalai Lama at his invitation. I did not initiate that. I did not initiate either one, actually. And so I've seen the power centers of two of the world's major religions anyway. And they're all misogynistic at a core level. They're all, or at the very least, patriarchal and patrilineal. And that, I think, is a major problem. And I think we're, you know, this Boko Haram thing and this group in Nigeria that's kidnapping young girls because they don't want them to go to public schools. That's the biggest threat to the world's religion, is the empowerment, the complete empowerment of women. And it's the thing that we have to be pushing the hardest for, because if you want to control world population, if you want peace in the planet, we need women to be, you know, not just having equal voices in our politics, but, you know, we need to have a female pope, and we need to have, you know, a female Dalai Lama, and those, you know, as wonderful as we might think His Holiness the Dalai Lama is, you know, I didn't have a conversation with him directly, personally, one-on-one about, you know, women in the Tibetan Buddhist Church, but I did have a conversation with a number of the people who are, you know, second tier, who hang out with him about that, and they are having no part of it. And the nuns basically in Dharamsala are more or less servants. And so this isn't to knock the Buddhists. I mean, you know, it's the same thing with it's in every religion. And so I think that the scandals and the cover-ups, and of course a lot of that's gay pedophilia, but still, it's that the misogyny in the church is in all churches, in all religions, and patriarchy in all religions is one of the biggest problems. Rose, thank you for the call. Thanks for letting me go off on that rant. I appreciate it. Thanks for listening to WBAM. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I think I told you all the story of when I met with the Archbishop of Bogota, and he went off on this rant about it's all the women's fault. Eve ate that apple. That's what caused it all. Pretty amazing stuff. Pretty amazing stuff. Maggie listening to WBAI, KBAI in Bellingham, Washington, other side of the country. Hey, Maggie, what's up?
Hi, I'm wanting to talk about Mr. Francis Bellamy. He composed the Pledge of Allegiance in 1892. There was no reference to under God in that. Since that time, it's been revised a few times, and it was not officially adopted by Congress until 1954.
Yeah, it was 54.
No, it was 1942. And
well, in 54 was when they put under God in there. It was during the Eisenhower administration anyway.
That's right. So yeah. Officially adopted 42, and then under God went in later. And I think that public meetings having to do with politics should be opened by that particular thing. It's loyalty to the flag, and it's loyalty to the Union.
But see, that's even the under God I object to, because, I'm there are people who are pantheists. I mean, you know, what about under gods?
You're a pantheist, touching trees and praying.
Well, I will tell you, I'm a pantheist Buddhist Christian.
Yeah, I understand completely.
Who's very fond of Hasidic Judaism.
Yes.
No, I'm serious. If somebody put a gun to my head and said, tomorrow morning you have to pick a religion and live it for the rest of your life, I would either become a Hasidic Jew or a Buddhist.
And as either one of those, I'm sure you would support a revision of the Pledge of Allegiance to delete under God.
Yeah.
And without the under God, I think that the Pledge of Allegiance should be what is said in the beginning of the public meetings, and that sort of ends the argument.
But Maggie, what's wrong with just saying our meeting comes to order? Why do we have to do the whole hoop-de-doop, you know, we're reaffirming? You know, one of the things that, if I can take this out of context for just a moment, I think you'll get the context in just a second. I am convinced that one of the reasons why these guys who are constantly running around, there's one in the press yesterday who are constantly talking about gay sex, an ostensibly straight guy who's trying to describe gay sex in the most horrible terms in order to trash gay people. I'm convinced that, you know, this guy is probably bisexual or gay himself, and he's just this is how he's dealing with it. And so he's coming out of a place of a fundamental insecurity. I am convinced that the most evangelical people I have met in my life, both religiously evangelical and atheistically evangelical, are doing so out of their own uncertainty. If I can only convince five more people, then maybe I'll convince myself. I think that's what's going on inside their heads. And I think that the Pledge of Allegiance is that same kind of thing. Yes, we really do believe in this country, sort of. Am I making sense?
Yes, of course it makes sense. If they must have a little opening, whatever, just to say, okay, now we're
ceremony.
Going to go to the agenda. That I think would be the least offensive to me with the deletion of under God.
Yeah.
The
go back to Bellamy's original pledge.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, I'm with you, Maggie. I would not object to that at all. I think is unnecessary. And arguably, what's the word when you're, phony, patriotic, whatever. There's a word for it. But, you know, you get it. But, Maggie, I'm with you. Thank you. We'll be back. Fancy. Anyway, welcome back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Maureen in Lancaster, California. Hey, Maureen, you wanted to talk about the Supreme Court ruling?
Yes, I also am part of a lawsuit against the city of Lancaster opening city council meetings with prayers to Jesus.
Oh, interesting. Now, does that mean that you're going to
beat us to the Supreme Court by about a week? I was told we've already been through local federal court.
Okay, so your case now is dead because of this
yes,
case of the Galloway
for the most
case.
Part, yeah. Yes. Huh. Yes, it is. It was myself and Shelley Rubin on this case.
Interesting.
But the reason why I got into the case to begin with was not really about the prayers themselves. I am not a rich woman, and this lawsuit was offered to me, so I jumped on it.
Hmm.
But the case in my city, we already have a mayor who has declared us a Christian city, that he was growing a Christian city. We had a city council member who was rabidly anti-Muslim and was scandalized when she came out with some very bigoted comments on her Facebook page.
Mm-hmm.
And we have funneled millions to about 5 select churches here, all Christian, in infrastructure, free land. A land exchange that cost us taxpayers $6 million to build a athletic field for my old alma mater, which is a Catholic church. And this is what happened. This is why it's so scary to allow this. It's definitely, you know, give an inch and they take a mile.
Yeah, this is the camel's nose under the edge of the tent. Yep.
Yeah, and it's really the problem with this. I never believed that before until I started paying attention to local politics.
Yeah, yeah.
Although I did find the prayers fairly offensive, we have some very, very fundamentalists here. We have a Baptist church that we actually have government meetings at. And we're not a small town. We have 150,000 residents.
Right.
And it's scary, the influence. We have people that join one church in particular for business contacts, and the common people in that church are pretty much restricted. It's a scary fundamentalist church.
Hmm.
So this is what happens, though. This is what happens when people don't take these laws seriously.
Yeah. No, I absolutely agree with you, Maureen, and this is why we need to be paying attention to this. Thank you for the call, and thanks for sharing the story with us. Gary in Medford, Oregon. Hey, Gary, what's up?
Hi, Tom. In regards to the first of all, excuse me reading my notes. This old brain is not as flexible as it used to be.
I know the feeling.
Yeah. We're both 63. In regards to the proposed constitutional amendments that corporations are not people and money isn't speech. I guess we all know how important that is. Even Pap earlier mentioned that 80% of people oppose Citizens United. But I'm concerned that it's a little premature without first preparing the battlefield for these amendments.
I agree. And that's what Move to Amend is trying to do. I mean, they're looking at a five-year window.
Okay, but what I'm proposing is that we focus more on the Disclose Act, and it's kind of interesting the way it works. For example, if in all the primary and general elections, if everybody asked each candidate how they voted on the Disclose Act and why not, it's going to put them on the spot. That's something we have to do first.
I don't think most people know what the Disclose Act is.
Most people don't. From my water cooler wars encounters, they don't.
Right. So, and the Disclose Act has not passed. And in fact, bring me up to date. I mean, I'm way behind.
Well, Nancy Pelosi brought it up twice in 2010, and it was killed both times. There's a Maine representative or senator, I can't remember his name, that's trying to bring it up again.
Right.
But it basically says exactly what the Supreme Court says, who by the way, also...
What the court recommended in Citizens United that the Congress do, which is make all campaign contributions transparent, both on the giving end and the receiving end.
Exactly. But the issue hasn't been pushed, and we haven't put all of our candidates on the spot, both
yeah.
Democrat and Republican, as to how they, if they or if they do not support
yeah.
it.
I'm with you, Tim. We need to push that. I got a whole bunch of calls. I want to try to get a few more here before the end of the show. We just have a few minutes. Michael in Dublin, Virginia.
Hi. I know you have to get through this.
Okay.
Let me say this. This is what I believe as a representative. Jesus would be in one of our representatives. In other words, the character. Everybody around the world knows the character of Jesus. So if someone like Bernie Sanders would open up, maybe say, for example, his presidential acceptance speech, I think that the character of Jesus in him, he would have a speech something similar to this. He would say, it is a great time for us to assemble today in this land and consider what is occurring in our nation. Rather than accept a substitution of our great democracy with one that favors a few rather than the many, let us gather together and mobilize our creative minds to explore the dawning of a new
yeah.
beginning and repairing
it's a great sentiment, Michael. Thank you for the call. Ed, in Pleasant Plains, Illinois, you wanted to correct me, and you are absolutely right. Go for it.
Tom, I'm not correcting you, but thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to pass on that there is a religion that honors women. It's called paganism.
You're right. You're right. The paganism or Wiccanism, right?
Wiccanism, yes.
Yeah. And
I'm one of them.
Yeah. Okay.
The five-pointed star, that thing about the five-pointed star. When it's upside down, that means the dark cycle.
Yeah. Well, and
that's where the Republicans are in
yeah.
the dark cycle.
Yeah. They definitely
apparently,
are.
Apparently. But anyway, maybe not.
Well, it definitely wasn't about paganism. I can tell you that. It was, you know. Maybe Bahomet or whatever his name is.
I don't know the history that well.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you, Ed, for correcting that. I appreciate it. Although the problem is that, you know, paganism is Tom Hartman not. Here. Thanks so much. It's bouncing. Watching and listening to the program. Paganism is not Tom one of the two great or the one of the five or six great religions of the world. I mean, you know, it's one of the more minor ones. So. Anyhow, coming up tomorrow, it's Friday, and that means it's Brunch with Bernie. America's Senator, Senator Bernie Sanders, will be here talking about the issues of the week. Plus, anything goes Friday, your chance to sound off on any topic. Chemtrails? And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It begins with you, Tay. You're it. Get out there and occupy something. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.